Let me urge you, if you've never taken advantage of a lectureship before, and very likely many of you who live in town do like a lot of us do, whenever it's right on our front door, we don't go. I have one in California, and we try to get out there for it, but here's one right at our front door, and we don't attend. If you'd like to take advantage of this Count It All Joy series in the lectureship, please get you one of the brochures in one of the foyers or in the office and take advantage of that good opportunity. For those of you who are visiting with us, and we are hoping that there'll be more and more of you each Sunday evening as we get into this series on the life of Christ, to you who are here tonight, we're very thankful for your coming and for your open mind as you investigate this material with us, as you look at the evidence about the man Jesus, who claims such preposterous claims for himself. If you look at him at all, they're astonishing, and we ask you to give it serious consideration. The Christ of the Bible is such a magnificent figure that whenever the writers of the Bible speak of him or even think of him, their minds instinctively bow down in worship and reverence and awe. And that's true whether it's in prospect, as Isaiah saw him and said, "To us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." And then John, in the Revelation, looking in retrospect, said that he saw around the throne of God and the living creatures and the elders, he heard the voice of many angels numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all therein saying, "To him who sits upon the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might unto the ages of the ages." And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. This Christ of the Bible is truly a magnificent character. And I ask you the question tonight, who is he? And I ask for a special purpose, and I'm asking that we introduce his life tonight and next Sunday night, because I want you to get somewhat of an idea about who it is we're looking at. I thought about just jumping off into it, and I thought, no, that's not best. I thought it would be best to introduce it like John the Apostle introduced his gospel. He has a prologue of 18 verses, and in that prologue he tells you who it is that he's going to tell you about. And he draws such a majestic picture of the Christ. And so in terms of this series, I wanted to do the same thing. I want to give you an overview and more or less feed your asking and feed your inquisitiveness with some thoughts on who this Jesus is, so that you can see somewhat of the scope and of the content of this quest that we'll be on for the next several weeks. And this one who demands our attention and who so then requires and deserves not only our attention but our respect, this is the one that I would like tonight for you to ask, and I'd like you to ask it seriously, and I'd like for us to try to answer it honestly. Who is this Jesus of Nazareth? And so I invite your attention tonight. Be a resourceful listener. Be inquisitive. Be what you ought to be as listeners, and see if we can't together look at some evidence tonight about the identity of this man. Who was he? There are two or three thoughts that I would like to leave with you by way of introduction The man Jesus of Nazareth was a man whose humanity anchors him in history just like any other human being that ever lived on the earth who was noteworthy. And I mean by that simply this. He was not just a man who came on the scene and had just one historical sighting. He was a man who had many historical sightings, even among those who were his enemies and among those who didn't even know him, but who were aware of his presence because of his influence that had spread beyond the borders of Israel at that time. There are Roman historians that bear witness to the life of Jesus. He was a man who was anchored in history in that respect. Pliny and others of the Roman people, their historians, these men bore witness, though it may be indirect, they bore witness to his followers primarily. But nevertheless, he is anchored in history in that respect. But also, when even his friends record and write things about him, we find them writing those things that are just ordinary things. We find them telling us things about him that allow us to read the life of this man. And we find that much of what he did is just common, ordinary things that could be written about any other man. For example, in the first few years of his life, they were spent in a little town of Nazareth in Galilee. It was nothing more than a little hillside village on a range of mountains that leads from the seacoast on inward. But this little village was sitting there, and it wasn't much more than just a very small town. And he spent his life there in the first 30 years of his life were really spent in the city of Nazareth. To the people of Nazareth, he was just a hometown boy. He was the son of Mary and the son of Joseph. They knew his brothers. They knew his sisters. They said, is this not Joseph's son? Is this not the son of Mary and his brothers? Are not they James, Joseph, and Simon, and Judas, and his sisters? They're still with us. Where does this man get these mighty works and this wisdom? But they were aware of him as just a hometown boy, primarily through those years. And yet those who knew him intimately, his kin people, his first and second cousins, and we don't know who else there were there that knew him intimately, but those who did know him were aware of the fact that his life was a resplendent life. For example, when Luke, in examining and going back into the situation, looked into the life of Jesus, he said he searched out diligently to find out what had happened back there. Luke records of the first 12 years of Jesus' life that simply that Jesus had grown and became strong and that he enjoyed the favor of God. Now he says that in Luke, the second chapter, and about verse 40. Then in verse 52, he records there the development of Jesus in the latter 18 years of his life, from 12 to 30, and simply says there that Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and men. And Luke simply records that Jesus was a well-rounded young man. He wasn't half-baked. He wasn't turned only once. Jesus developed socially. He developed mentally, spiritually, and physically. And so Luke just simply says he was a well-rounded man. When John the Baptist was presented with a dilemma, really, Jesus came and said, I want you to baptize me. John bore witness to the exemplary life of Jesus when he said, I need you to baptize me, and you come to me to be baptized? Now, that's an indirect way that John had of saying Jesus' life was exemplary, it was spotless. And John bore witness to it on that occasion. Even Josephus, who himself was a Jew, who was almost identically contemporary with Jesus, perhaps he was a bit younger than Jesus, but nevertheless, he was a Jew. He wrote a Jewish history. He also wrote for the Romans. But Josephus knew about Jesus from Nazareth. And he bore witness in a small clipping or a fragment that was found. It's a 4th century fragment. It's a quotation by a man by the name of Agapius, an Arab bishop in Baghdad, years and years and years ago. He makes this reference to a statement by Josephus. Similarly, Josephus the Hebrew says, at that time there was a wise man called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. That's a very simple and brief statement by a man, but nevertheless, it's a historical record or historical sighting and I think it's worthy of your consideration. Jesus was a man whose humanity, his early years, his being a man anchored him in history as someone who was just like a lot of us in many of the things that he did. For example, in the latter part of his life, the last 3.5 years or so, that include his personal ministry, and this is what the majority of the gospel record includes, this man was shown by the gospel writers to be a man who had desires, who had his body desires and all of this. He needed things to drink, he needed rest, he needed quiet, he needed all of these things that you and I need. For example, he was a man who appreciated beauty. In Matthew, the 7th chapter, at the conclusion, or about the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus there, whether he picked one of those flowers, the lilies of the field, and looked at the beauty of it and the symmetry, or whether he just pointed to it, we don't know. But he said, look at the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor do they spin. And yet I say that even Solomon was not arrayed like one of these. Even in all of his glory, he wasn't arrayed like one of these lilies of the field. And so you find him as a man who could appreciate beauty. He was not a man who was separate from people. He was not a man who was separate from things. He wore good clothes. The garment that he had on was not a beggar's robe. It was seamless, which meant that it was a very expensive piece of clothing. Well, Jesus could do that. And how, I don't know, but someone probably gave it to him, but he accepted it and wore it. He was a man that appreciated beauty. He appreciated hospitality. He appreciated rest and solitude. On one occasion, he tried to get some rest and solitude, and people wouldn't let him, not on just one, on many occasions. But on one occasion, after having taught for quite a while, he got in a boat and told his disciples, let's go over to a quiet place and rest. And the people knew where he was going, and they outran him and got over there first. And they were there on the shore like sheep without a shepherd. And he came ashore and taught them many things. Then a few minutes later, he fed them. And then he dismissed them, and he told his disciples, get in a boat and leave. And then he went up into what Terry called last week or two a ravine, and he stayed there for a while and prayed and stayed by himself. He needed some quiet. He was a man that needed that. On another occasion, he was a man who was so tired that he slept through a storm. He got in a boat, and his disciples were in the boat, and they were rowing across the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus was back in the stern, it says, and he was sound asleep on a pillow. And he was so asleep that even the storm, beating and pouring into the boat, it didn't even wake him. And when the boat was about to sink, they went over and had to wake him up and said, Lord, get up. We're sinking. Don't you care? And he stilled the storm. But nevertheless, he was a man that could catch a nap during a storm. On another occasion, we find he was in need of something to drink. He was sitting by the well there in the city of Sychar. He was tired from a journey. Sat there by the well, sent his disciples into town to buy some food. And he sat there, and it says he was wearied from his journey, and he asked the woman for a drink of water. We found one occasion in Luke, the 11th chapter, where Jesus didn't wash his hands before he ate. This blew the mind of the Pharisee that had asked him to his home. I think Jesus did it intentionally to draw the man out, to show him a lesson that things that are really important are not washing the dirt off of the outside, but the inside should be clean. But that occasion showed his humanity. I find it one of the most amusing and amazing portraits of this Son of God that he would be recorded as having not washed his hands before he ate. He wept with friends over the death of another friend. Though he was going to raise the man from the dead, he was moved by the sorrow of these two sisters. He wept still yet again over the city of Jerusalem. As he could picture in his mind what was coming to the city, he could almost see the Roman armaments being placed on the hills and being released upon the city, and the ballistas going against the city, whistling and trying to destroy the walls. And he wept and said, Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that stones the prophets and kills those that are sent unto you. How oft would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you would not. And he simply wept. But that's the kind of man that we find recorded, and you could say on and on so many more things about him, but he was a man whose humanity anchors him to time. He was recorded and borne witness to by people who were not his friends, people who were on the outside of Israel more or less, but they still bore witness to him. He was borne witness to by his own friends, and in their writings, he's just simply a man who could be recorded in such language that you could read what he did without even raising your eyebrows. And yet, it'll have to be said tonight that he's not a man that can be confined to historical classifications like ordinary men can be. Obviously, we wouldn't be here if he were. If he were the kind of man that I could just sit down after having told you that he was a human, then we wouldn't be here tonight worshiping him. We've gathered here tonight to worship him as a God. And so it is. He defies normal human classification and limitations. And two ways particularly I want to mention to you. One of them, I suppose both of them are important. One of them, though, absolutely dumbfounds me. I'm going to mention it second. Let's notice the first one of these first. He was overwhelming in his presence. I don't know whether your reading of the Gospels of Jesus produced this effect on you or not, but he was a man that was literally overwhelming in his presence. I think it can be illustrated by the fact that at the very beginning of his ministry, he had such a powerful personality that when he came into the regions of Galilee, and it says, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. And then he came on into Nazareth and went to the synagogue, as was his custom, went there, and they gave him a scroll of Isaiah to read from. He stood up and read a passage that spoke of the Spirit of the Lord being placed upon him. And then he sat down, gave the attendant the book, sat down, and all the eyes of the synagogue were fixed upon him. And he was there in such a power and strength that he could say, today, you have heard this scripture fulfilled in your ears. And it says that the people marveled at him and were amazed at the gracious words that proceeded out of his mouth. And then maybe 5 or 10 minutes later, it doesn't give the time sequence here, but the very next statement it says, that they said to him, is this not Joseph's son? Then where does he get all of these things? And he said to them, doubtless you'll quote to me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. What we've heard that you did at Capernaum, do here also in your own country. And then he chided them and gave them a lesson and says that there were many lepers in the days of Elisha and there were many widows in the days of Elisha, but God didn't send anybody to feed them or to cleanse them. He sent them rather to the people of Syria and he sent them to these other people, the widow of Zarephath. And it made these people in Nazareth so mad that they seized him, carried him out to the brow of the city and attempted to throw him over the city and kill him. And he just simply, by the sheer presence and power of his own personality, he just simply walked through the midst of those people, and they backed up like the waters parted at the Red Sea when the children of Israel left it some 1,400 years earlier. That was just simply the sheer force of his own powerful personality. It's similar to what happened at the last of his personal ministry when he was there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and the men who were going to arrest him came. And he asked them the question, who are you looking for? And they said, we are looking for Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, I am he. And the man, it says that the whole crowd of them just fell backward to the ground. That wasn't any magic or any miraculous acting either. It was just simply the power of his own personality had so preceded him that they didn't know what to expect. And I suspect that it was just like the domino theory. One fell, and then all the others just fell right on back. And I suspect that the first man who was standing in front of him backed up. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't step on the fellow's feet behind him. And as he fell, the other fellow couldn't move, and he just fell, and the whole lot of them fell backwards on the ground. That's the sort of man that he was. He was powerful in his personality. Almost overnight, he gained a reputation as being a teacher. And this happened almost overnight. And he was such a reputable character in his teachings that the people said, this man speaks with authority, not like our scribes. And one of the words that's used to describe Jesus more than any other word is the word astonished. They were astonished at him, or they were exceedingly astonished at him, astonished at his teachings, astonished at all that he did and all that he said. This man gained a popularity. He gained a reputation as being a teacher beyond the teachings of the scribes and the Pharisees. You might say, well, that was at the beginning of his personal ministry, though. What happened when people got to know him? What happened when his friends got to know him? Did they not see that he was just more like themselves than they had originally thought? No, not so. You might think they would have. You know, whenever you get to know someone better, as you've gotten to know me, you see, he's not so hot after all. You know, after the honeymoon is over and you begin to see, well, now there's a flaw in him and there's a mistake he's made. But it's the same way with you. As I get to know you, I know you're not so hot either, and we just have to kind of give and take with each other. Wasn't that bound to happen with this man Jesus? Well, they walked the dusty roads with him. They did everything that is the normal, everyday carryings on with people. They walked up the steep incline to Jerusalem with him. They sat out in the fields and listened to him talk. They saw an incident arise where about 5,000 men offered themselves as Jesus' soldiers and were going to take Jesus and make him their ruler, their king. They saw him have that opportunity to rise to power prematurely. They saw how he acted. They went through the city of Jericho with him, hot, arid. They could sit there by a well or watch him as he sat there tired. They could sleep under the stars with him. And on and on and on you can go. They enjoyed the hospitality of Bethany. They were with him during the pressures and the tension of the city of Jerusalem. They were there during his trial. They saw him as he manifested such a tremendous character and control of himself all through their life, to where at the same time that he was more and more a revelation to them, at the same time he was more and more a mystery. So really their awe and their respect for him continued to just grow and increase to the point that they were just astonished more and more at this man's life. That's the kind of a person he was. But surely his enemies, surely they would have found out his weak point. Wouldn't they have found the chink in his armor, you know, after questioning him for 3.5 years? Surely he would at least have one time have slipped up and made some kind of a statement that wasn't right. And yet you don't find that. And they put him to every kind of imaginable test to see if they couldn't mix him up and get him caught in some kind of a dilemma. But they never caught him. In Matthew, the 22nd chapter, they had 3 different teams even. They had, a kickoff team and a defense team and an offense team. They had all this going for them. And they sent one team in there and they said, look, tell us about taxes. What should we do about paying taxes to Caesar? Well, they came back out all beaten and bruised, emotionally and psychologically. And they said, go in and get him. And another team went in and they said, tell us about the resurrection. And he put that to quiet, and they came out all bedraggled, and they said, send in another team. And they sent in another team, the Pharisees this time, and they said, tell us, what's the greatest law? And Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and mind and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. Do this, he says, and you'll live. There's no other greater than these two. On these hang the law and the prophets. Well, they were all just absolutely battered, by the great wisdom of this man. And while they were standing there trying to recover, he said, now I want to ask you a question. Tell me about the Christ. Whose son is he? Oh, and they said, well, he's David's son. Boy, we got one answer, right? He said, really? He said, if he was David's son, then how is it that David in the Spirit spoke and said, the Lord, that is Jehovah, said to my Lord, sit on my right hand until I make your enemies the footstool of your feet. Jesus said, if the Christ was David's son, how is it that David called him Lord? And he just waited for that to sink in, probably. And they weren't able to answer, it says. Not only were they not able to answer, but it says, no more did anyone from that day on dare ask him any more questions. They just couldn't handle him. Not only was that true, they couldn't trip him up in his questions. They couldn't get him to betray himself in his words. But whenever they sent people to arrest Jesus, these officers came back empty-handed and they said, well, where is he? And they said, sir, never man so spoke like this man. They couldn't even arrest him. They had to resort to mob violence in order to do him in. He was just simply an astonishing, overwhelming personality in his presence. There's no way we can really sense just how potent, just how powerful he really was. That there was something about him. He wasn't beautiful. He wasn't handsome. He was just simply sheer, unadulterated, manly, godly power. And it came through with some sort of force and power that made people know that they'd been in the presence of someone very unusual. But there's a second thought that I'd like to leave with you tonight. And it's something that I've not been able to grasp in the fullest extent, but it's something that jars me. And I want you to get the implications of it. Do you know this man that we're studying about had no consciousness of sin? He had no consciousness of sin. Now, we're aware of the fact that the Bible claims for him that he had no sin. I understand that. The Hebrew writer says that he had no sin. Simon Peter says he had no sin. The Apostle Paul says he had no sin. And I understand it and I accept that. But the thing that drives that in and makes it understandable is that the Bible also, from Matthew to Revelation, lets us see without any doubt that not only did he have no sin, this man had no consciousness of sin. He had no consciousness of sin. Now, hang on to that just a minute. You say, well, what's so amazing about that? When you add to that one beautiful fact that he had no consciousness of sin, when you add to that the fact that he was always and is today known to be the very epitome of that which is good, then you've got an irreconcilable dilemma unless you acknowledge the fact that he was the Son of God or that he was divine. Here's what I mean. Every man that you know of that is a good man, or every woman that you know of that is a good woman, and I don't mean just here in our age, I'm talking about as far back as human history goes. Every good man or woman has lying at the base of their piety or their goodness an overwhelming sense of being incomplete or being sinful or being less than what they ought to be. Everyone. Now, is that not right? Dr. Farah, isn't that psychologically, that's right. You can't point to a person who is a really good person that is not correspondingly aware of his being unworthy. Now, let me give you some examples of it. Isaiah. Isaiah was a good man. But at the very beginning of our knowledge of Isaiah, whenever he had his call to go and work for God, this is how he began it. Woe is me, for I'm lost. For I'm a man of unclean lips, and I am amidst of a people who have unclean lips. But he spoke of this thing of being unworthy and of being really lost and sinful. The Apostle Peter was another good man. And we look at him with awe and with many times with just great respect as he developed into the kind of man that we see him later in the New Testament. But that man, one day Jesus approached him, and there was an incident there where he helped him catch some fish, and Simon Peter just saw something there, and he knelt before Jesus and said, Lord, depart from me, I'm a sinful man. He was aware of his sinfulness. And then the Apostle Paul, who developed into such a fantastic character, whose goodness no one really could question, that man said in 1 Timothy 1:15, I am the chief of sinners. And you can just multiply that by however many you want to multiply it. Every good man, lying at the base of his piety, there is this awareness of his not being worthy, of the awareness that he is himself a sinner. And I almost could say that to the degree that a person is aware of his sinfulness, to that degree he attains genuine nobility or genuine goodness. But not so with Jesus Christ. Though the noblest men are those who are most conscious of their imperfections, not Jesus. This man had no consciousness of sin whatsoever, and yet he was known to be the very epitome of goodness. This man claimed to have so represented God that he actually brought honor and glory to God. This man had no seeming regret for any word that he spoke. He had no regret for any action that he did or any thought that he had. He just simply had no consciousness of having failed or having come to a point of imperfection. There's just not any consciousness of it there. Now, that may not impress you. I think it ought to. I believe that ought to impress you because it'll show you the nature of this man. He's the only person in the human history who has ever been unconscious of sin and yet been the epitome of that which is good. Now, look at the alternatives. There have been people who've been unconscious of sin. Hitler was one. But that kind of person is a moral reprobate. They are what psychologists call sociopaths. They have no moral sensitivity. They have no moral awareness. Not only are they not aware of any guilt or any sin or any wrongdoing, they don't have any awareness of what's right. And they can wipe off the face of the earth some 6 million Jews. That's what happens to a person if he is mentally capable, if he's morally reprobate and still stands up before the world and says, I haven't done anything wrong, then he walks over you with hobnail boots, and if you get in his way, he'll just simply kill you. Well, that's one I think Hitler could be said of him that he had no real sense of wrong or sense of sin. The man just simply did as he pleased, but he didn't have any moral sensitivity. The other kind of person who doesn't have any sense of sin is the moron. A moron doesn't have any sense of sin either, but he doesn't have the mental capacity for it. He's just simply incapable mentally of comprehending sin. He's not responsible. And that kind of person is just harmless, you know, and they have to be usually taken care of. But look at Jesus of Nazareth. He's the only man who had no consciousness of sin, and yet at the same time has always been recognized as being the very epitome of what's good. Now listen, there just ain't nobody else like that in the history of the human race. Never. He's the only one. That stuns me. It shocks me. And I find myself saying, well, Lord, I'll just have to reckon with that. I can't discard it. I can't ignore it. I'll have to reckon with it. And I think it's absolutely beautiful. Though we know he had no sin, right? But the thing that stuns me tonight as I present this to you so that you might know who it is that we're going to be studying about, here's a man that had not only no sin, he had no consciousness of sin in himself. And yet he was the utmost of what's good. Well, here was a man who was anchored in history by his humanity. He was like one of us, tempted in all points like we are. And yet you can't define him in terms of just normal definitions. He was a man who was more than just what could be described as a historical person. He was historical in the sense of being human, yes, but he was also historical in the sense of being divine. He was magnificent in his personality. He was powerful in his presence. And the man had no consciousness of sin and yet stands today as the very epitome of what's good. I present him to you tonight with wonder and amazement. You'll have to answer him. You'll have to answer to him. What if you were to stand before him tonight? One day you'll have to, and so will I. Have you acknowledged him as the Son of God? Have you ever come and confessed your faith in him, that he's the Christ, the Son of the living God, or not? How great thou art was written about Jesus Christ, written about his Father. There's no other way to explain him. Tonight, if you've not confessed him as your Lord and you would like to put him on in baptism, you'd like to become one of his disciples, we urge you to do that tonight and not put it off any longer. If you believe in him genuinely and would like to be his without reservation, we offer you the invitation tonight to do that. And those of us who are Christians, may your sense of awe and reverence be deepened by our having looked at him tonight, and we'll continue to do that for weeks in the future. May God bless you. If you have a need at all, we urge you to come and express it tonight while we stand and sing.